We come tonight to our third study, which is Leviticus chapter 16 to chapter 22. Largely, this section is concerned with what I have called moral questions. It's quite a spicy section, but before we get on to some of the spicier bits, let's just look at chapters 16 and 17, which say some very important things concerning a few of the ritualistic practices, particularly in relation to the Day of Atonement and the significance of blood in the Israelite system. All of the sacrifices we have seen earlier contained some imperfection. We know that they were animal sacrifices, and the blood of animals, for example, couldn't really take away the sins. And then, of course, the sacrifices had to be offered regularly, even daily. Burnt offerings were offered daily, showing that the sacrifice wasn't efficacious even for 24 hours. These imperfections were driven home to the people by the fact that once a year, on the Day of Atonement, there was opportunity given for all the faults and failings and sins of the previous year that had been overlooked to be brought together for a general ceremonial cleansing. On this one day of a year, access was available into the most holy place. That's the small rear room of the tabernacle building. Normally, nobody could go in, but on this one day of the year, the high priest did have access into the very presence of God, into that room. So on this one day when access was available, all the sins and bits and pieces and the leftovers and hangovers from the previous year were brought together and atonement was asked. The first thing is that the priest had to offer sacrifices for himself. We saw that last week, that before we can go around trying to fix other people up, we have to deal with our own shortcomings. And so the priests, first of all, offered sin offerings on behalf of themselves. We notice that they sacrificed a bull, referred to in chapter 16, verse 11. He brings a bull as a sin offering for himself, that is, Aaron the high priest. And not only for himself, but for his sons, his assistant priests. And the ritual was something like this. They sacrificed the bull on the altar out in the open courtyard, and then blood was collected in a basin. They went into the tabernacle building, that is inside the tent. They took the blood, and it was applied at the altar of incense, that is the altar where the prayers and the incense was burnt to ascend up to God. And then it was actually taken inside that rear room. The veil, the curtain, was pulled back, and for once only in the year, the high priest went in to the symbolic presence of God, the Ark of the Covenant, with the lid of the Ark being called the mercy seat, and he sprinkled the blood there. The significance of this, to me, is overwhelming. With all the rituals we've seen in the yearly round of all the Israelite ceremonies and practices, with all the rituals, with all the sacrifices, all the ceremonies, all the laws, in spite of all of those things, the forgiveness ultimately depended only upon the mercy of God. That's why it was called the mercy seat. After all of those rituals had been gone through, and they had penetrated to the very heart of the Israelite religion, this was the climax of the year. And when they got to the very heart of things, still their forgiveness depended entirely upon the mercy of God. And that's why it was called a mercy seat. It was only in his mercy that God allowed them to come into his presence and to obtain his forgiveness. As we've seen previously, we have no right to forgiveness. God, in his mercy, forgives. It's mentioned there in chapter 16, verse 14. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the front of the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. The mercy seat being the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, which symbolized the presence of God. Having offered his own sin offering, the priest then offered the sin offering on behalf of the people. Now, the people's sin offering consisted of two goats. The first goat was sacrificed with blood ritual similar to that of the sin offering on behalf of the high priest. The only difference was that the priest's offering was a bull. In the case of the people, it was a goat, a smaller animal. Verse 15. He shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring its blood within the veil, that is, behind the curtain that separated the front room from the back room inside the tabernacle tent. And he shall do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling it upon the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. And so it goes on, the same ritual for the people. That's the first of the goats. But there were two goats. And the second goat was then taken and it wasn't sacrificed. And a very interesting ritual takes place here. This second goat is called the goat for Azazel. In my Bible it's called that. That's the Hebrew word. Nobody knows exactly how to translate it. And in the old King James Version it was translated scapegoat, and in other versions it's translated by other things. The word Azazel is what is used. It's mentioned, for example, in verse 8. Aaron shall cast lots over the two goats for the people's sin offering, one lot for the Lord, that is the animal that was sacrificed to the Lord on the altar, and the other lot for Azazel. And then in verse 10 it mentions again the lot that fell for Azazel. This animal, this second animal, was sent away to Azazel, and it appears that it means something like this. It has something to do with an offering in the wilderness, that this animal was sent away into the wilderness. And the ritual was this. They brought this live animal and then laid the hands on the head of the animal and confessed over the animal all the sins of the people. So in effect, now that animal has all the sins upon it. And now that that animal is bearing all those sins, it is taken away by somebody as far away as they can go, and it's let go into the bush where it will wander away and never come back. You can see again a very graphic picture of the removal of sin. So first of all we have the sacrificial ritual, which is fairly well known to them, but now this other very dramatic way of saying your sin is removed, as the Bible says somewhere, as far as the east is from the west, or buried in the bottom of the ocean. I've removed your transgressions far away. And so that goat goes off, never to return. The sins have been forgiven, and away they go. So again, these are pictures. We've seen it time and time again. They are practical illustrations of the atonement and the removal and forgiveness of sin, referred to in verse 20. When he has made an end of atoning for the holy place and the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall present the live goat, that's the second goat of the sin offering of the people, and Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them upon the head of the goat, and he shall send him away into the wilderness by a hand of a man who is in readiness. And the goat shall bear all their iniquities upon him to a solitary land, and he shall let the goat go in the wilderness. And that is the end of that. I'll just read you a few verses from the New Testament. I'm not going to comment on these, I'm not asking you to look at them, but just hear how the writer to the Hebrews applies the Day of Atonement rituals to our Lord Jesus Christ, who of course was our great high priest. Just listen to these words. These various preparations having thus been made, the priests go continually into the outer tent, performing their ritual duties, that's into the front room, the holy place, but into the second room, the most holy place, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and then for their people. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the sanctuary is not yet opened as long as the old tabernacle was standing. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then, through a greater and more perfect tent, he entered once for all into the holy place, not through the blood of goats or calves, but through his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption, not just a temporary thing for the next 12 months, but an eternal redemption. For if the sprinkling of defiled persons with the blood of goats and bulls and with the ashes of a heifer sanctifies for the purification of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify your consciences from dead works to serve the living God? For Christ has entered not into a sanctuary made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to die himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place yearly with blood, not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now just a note on chapter 17 of Leviticus concerning the sacredness of blood. We saw at the beginning that blood symbolized life, therefore shed blood symbolized death. It's referred to there in verse 11. The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by reason of the life. That is, a life is taken in the place of the one under condemnation, and therefore the one under condemnation can be forgiven because there has been a substitutionary death. Verse 14, for the life of every creature is the blood of it. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any creature, for the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. Now here again we have the language of grace. Life belonged to God. All animal life belonged to God. And life could therefore only be taken by God's consent. When the people took the life of an animal to use its flesh as meat, they were not allowed to use the blood for themselves. Normally the blood was drained out on the ground, or in the case of some of these sacrifices, it was collected in a bowl and it was applied to the altar and various ritualistic things were done with it. But man was not allowed to use this blood for himself. And the significance of that is that the blood signifies the life of the animal which has been taken. So man acknowledges that he has taken the animal's life only by God's permission, because God is the owner of all life. And in thanks to God for being allowed to take the animal's life, he therefore pours the blood out as a sort of sacrificial demonstration of thanks to God for benefits which he receives at the cost of the animal's life. Blood was therefore forbidden for people to use for their own benefit. And now here's the language of grace. The very thing that was strictly forbidden, God now gives freely. He gives that thing that was forbidden. He gives it now as the means of atonement. The blood I give to you, he says, to make atonement. It's a magnificent picture of the grace of God, which gives the very thing, you might say, which is the very last of all the things that man is entitled to use for himself. And yet God in his grace gives. Why? Because God wants man to be reconciled, and God provides the way of reconciliation. God provides the way back. Man is cut off, he's hopeless, he cannot save himself, he cannot do anything to bring himself back to God because he's a sinner. And God looks upon him in his helplessness, and God is full of mercy. It's the mercy seat again. It's the grace of God, and God gives man the blood to make atonement. Just a practical point here in chapter 17. Remember that the people at this time are travelling through the wilderness, and they're all camped around the central tabernacle. When they set up camp, the tabernacle was in the middle, and then the tents of all the people were arranged round about. And the law was this, that animals which were allowed as food, but which were not allowed as sacrifices, could be killed anywhere. For example, fish. Or some other animal, maybe some sort of bird, and a person wants to eat it. Okay, says God, it's an animal that is okay for food. It's not an unclean animal like a pig or something of that nature. It's a clean animal. It's a suitable animal, but it's not an animal that is acceptable for sacrifice. So he says you can kill it anywhere and eat it. But if it is an animal that's acceptable for sacrifice, such as a goat or a lamb or a calf, then God says you can only kill that animal by bringing it to the central place of worship and sacrificing it on the altar. And then the meat of that animal was eaten in a ritual meal, a peace offering, for example. Now that was a very good arrangement as long as the people were around about the tabernacle, because they were all within walking distance of the central place of worship. You find later on when you read Deuteronomy and you get these laws repeated that many of them are updated, because then it's 40 years later and the people are about to enter the land. And when they go into the land, they're going to be spread far and wide all over the place. Obviously, it's going to be impractical to have to come miles and miles and miles to the altar simply to kill a calf or a lamb because you want to eat some lamb. So then the law you find is adjusted. And there it says that these animals, which are animals legitimately sacrificed, they said those animals, you can kill them for meat in your local district. So a person then could kill a goat or a sheep or a calf in his local district if he simply wanted some food. He didn't have to come all the way to the tabernacle to make a ritual out of it. But of course, if it was to be offered as a sacrifice, then it had to be offered only at the central place of worship. That's just an interesting comment when you compare Leviticus with Deuteronomy, and you find again how these rules, although there is significance in them, they're not hard and fast in the sense that no adjustment is made for variations of circumstances. I think we saw that last week, how that the law, although it laid down these laws, did leave elbow room so that when conditions changed, the laws could be adjusted to suit the new conditions. But the underlying meaning of things remained constant. All right, we now come on to chapters 18, 19 and 20, and these are the moral questions that I talked about. Largely, these are concerned with sexual relationships, or chapter 18 is, And in chapter 20, you get the penalties for many of the sins talked about in chapter 18. Chapter 18 outlines the sins, chapter 20 gives the penalties. And then in between you have chapter 19, which talks about a lot of miscellaneous matters. We are told in the opening verses of chapter 18 that things were bad in Egypt, and they're going to be just as bad in Canaan. That's in verse 3. You shall not do as they did in Egypt, and neither shall you do as they do in Canaan. The place where Israel had come from was bad, and the place that they were going to was also bad. The moral standards were very low. Therefore, God says, don't be corrupted by the moral standards of the people among whom you live. And of course, the lesson for the Christian here is fairly obvious, that once again, as God's people, we live among people who have different values, and we are not to let our values slip through being influenced by these. A lot of the sins talked about here are sexual aberrations. They are sexual sins which are really quite repulsive when you read about them. The expression that's used constantly is the expression, uncover the nakedness of. Now that's just a euphemism. A euphemism is a polite way of saying something that you don't like to say in plain terms. Instead of saying the person died, we say he passed away. It just sounds a little bit nicer. It's a euphemism. Sexual intercourse is what he's really talking about, but they say uncover the nakedness of because it just sounds a little bit nicer. The sexual relations that are talked about here are nearly all of the type where people are closely related. And the sexual relations between these closely related people are forbidden. For example, brother and sister, father and daughter, mother and son. You'll get the picture here as you just read a few. I'm not going to go through and read every single verse. Once you've got the general drift, I think you'll understand what's happening here. Look at verse 6, for example. None of you shall approach anyone near of kin to him to uncover nakedness. There's that uncover nakedness. In other words, nobody should go to a person who's a very close relative and have sex with them. That's what he's saying. I am the Lord, I'm holy. Verse 7 is an example. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father. Now this is spoken to a girl. The girl is not to have sexual relations with her father, which is the nakedness of your mother. In other words, the father belongs to the mother. She's entitled to have sex with him, but the daughter is not. So you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father because he belongs to your mother. That's addressed to the girl. Verse 8 is addressed to the son. To the boy, it said, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. In other words, she belongs to your father. And then it goes on in verse 9, again addressed to the son, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister. And so it goes on. You've got the picture here. You go through case after case after case. And the essence of it all is, again, that word at the beginning of verse 6, those near of kin. Now, just leaving that for a minute, we'll look at a couple of other things here. I want to draw your attention to four cases that are talked about. And I want you to notice the words that are used in each of these four cases. Chapter 18, verse 22. This concerns homosexuality. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. That's the first one. Now the second one is verse 23. You shall not lie with any beast. This is bestiality. You shall not lie with any beast and defile yourself with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to a beast to lie with it. It is a perversion. Go across to chapter 20 and we'll look at our third case. Chapter 20, verse 14. If a man takes a wife and her mother also, it is wickedness. Pretty repulsive sort of a setup, this one. A man's got the woman and also the girl's mother. So that's verse 14. And the fourth case is chapter 20, verse 17. If a man takes his sister, a daughter of his father or a daughter of his mother, and sees her nakedness and she sees his, it is a shameful thing. Now, they're the four cases that I want to just draw your attention to. Just a couple of more things before we leave these chapters. I'm going to come back to this in a moment. Notice what he says about the occult in chapter 20, verse 6. I'm not going to develop this about the occult, but it's worth filing away in the memory. If a person turns to mediums and wizards playing the harlot after them, I will set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. And then verse 27, a man or a woman who is a medium or a wizard shall be put to death. And just flip back to chapter 18. There's one other point I'd like to notice here. Chapter 18, verse 26. which tells us that these laws, although they apply to Israel, are not peculiar to Israel. He says in verse 26, "You shall keep my statutes and my ordinances and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you." So a native Israelite and also the foreigners in the land, the same laws were required of both of them. Now I'm going to come back to that in a few moments. Flip over now to chapter 19, if you would. This is the chapter that's sandwiched between those two spicy chapters. Now, chapter 19 is a fascinating chapter. One of those chapters I have enormous fun with, because it just says so many interesting things. You could preach a dozen sermons off this chapter, really, when you look at the things that are talked about. Now, there are so many things here that I'm going to classify them according to three categories. We'll just look at them very quickly under these three categories. The first category I've called social responsibility. My responsibility to the people who live round about me in my community. For example, verse 9. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field to its very border, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. When you strip your vineyard, you shall not strip it bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the sojourner." So they're the farmers, when they reap the ground, reap the harvest, or when they harvested their grapes, they were not to go back and pick up all the leftovers, they were to leave those for the poor and the aliens to come and gather for themselves. There were no welfare handouts by the government in those days, but the people were nevertheless to be considerate of the poor among them. So there is one of their social responsibilities. They weren't just to stuff themselves full of everything, they were to realise that other people had needs. Verse 11, another responsibility, don't steal. Verse 13, another one, do not oppress your neighbour or rob him. And the wages of a hired servant shall not remain with you all night until the morning. There again, here was the person who didn't have any reservoir of money, any fund of money to draw upon. He was a hand-to-mouth worker, poor person. And so he says, pay him regularly so that he's got enough to live by. It's all right for the person that's well shod. He's got a nice cushion that he can rest on. But the poor don't have that sort of backup financial strength. And so he says, give them their wages on the spot. That's a very simple piece of consideration for others. Verse 15, another one. Do no injustice in judgment. And notice the even-handedness here. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. Now, if you live in some of the third world countries, you'll find that everybody defers to the great, and the poor people have just no way at all of gaining the most elementary of justice that you and I take for granted. We take for granted that we're going to get elementary justice in the normal course of life. But the poorer people in those countries have no way at all of gaining the most elementary justice. It's always deferring to the great. Now, in our countries, sometimes we now find in our Western world, there's a swing in the opposite direction at times, so that people then become anti anybody who has wherewithal or influence or status in society. And sometimes those people lack justice because of the bias that's against them. So we can swing to the extreme in either direction, can't we? Well, look at the even-handed justice here. You don't be partial to the poor, but neither are you partial to the great. Regardless of the person's status, you administer strict justice. Verse 17, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. In the law of Moses, notice, never get the idea that the law of Moses encourages people to be vindictive. That is one of the greatest misunderstandings that there is. A lot of people think that the law of Moses taught the Jews to be vindictive. It did not teach the Jews to be vindictive. You get the same teaching of the New Testament here in the Old Testament. Look at it, verse 17. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. Now that could come from the Sermon on the Mount, couldn't it? The teaching that Jesus gave on the Sermon on the Mount was not original. What he was doing was driving them back to the law. They had neglected what was in the law. They had become legalistic, they had invented their own interpretations, their own traditions, they had become hard, and they had missed entirely the spirit of the law of Moses. And Jesus drove them back to basics. They said, you shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy. You don't get that in the law of Moses. That's what they said, but they didn't say it through quoting the Bible. The Bible doesn't say, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. The Bible says, love your neighbour and love your enemy as well. In fact, there's another verse later on, or is it back in Exodus, where it says, if you see your enemy's ox lying under its load, or his ass fallen on the ground, pick it up, help him, and don't bear a grudge in your heart. In fact, it says that here. verse 18, look at that. You shall not take vengeance. You see, that's the law of Moses. The law of Moses didn't tell people to take vengeance. The law of Moses taught people not to take vengeance. You shall not take vengeance or even bear a grudge. Now that's good Pauline teaching. You get that in the epistles of Paul. And yet there it is in the law of Moses, in Leviticus of all places. You shall not bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbour as yourself. Some people thought Jesus was the original teacher of that, but he wasn't. He was simply quoting the law. You shall love your neighbour as yourself is as old as the law of Moses. The eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth thing, people, I think, totally misunderstand. The Israelites were not taught to get square with people by taking an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Those places where that law is mentioned are where it's talking about giving a punishment to fit the crime, as the Mikado would say. You have a punishment which is proportionate to the crime. If it was a minor offence, you have a light punishment, a bruise for a bruise. If it was a major offence, you had a heavy punishment, an eye for an eye, scratch for scratch, tooth for tooth. The punishment fits the crime. Now that's the basis, and that was given to the magistrates, that was given to the law keepers, so that when they were judging cases brought before them, they could work on a fair and just basis. But in their personal relationships, people were to be loving and forgiving, and they're not to bear grudges. Now that's what we're taught too. But of course the people of Israel were very quick to distort things and to seize upon the laws that were given to these magistrates to decide cases justly and to use those things for themselves. And so forget about these other things that were written there. Now we do precisely the same. So many Christians are hard as nails when it comes to writing the letter of the law on certain matters of discipline and, you know, the sorts of things. We've got these hardliners that have chapters and verses, and they ride those to the ground and they forget other verses that are there concerning our consideration and our love and our forgiveness and all sorts of other things. There is no easy way out of many of these problems. And there is often no way other than a lot of personal self-sacrifice and burying of pride and showing love even when sometimes we don't feel inclined to. So there's some of our social responsibilities. Come to verse 32. Respect the aged, don't rise up against the hoary head. Verse 33. When a stranger sojourns with you, you shall not do him wrong. In other words, you don't be a racist. Again, people tend to think that the Jews were encouraged to be racist. Well, they're not. They're told here to treat the stranger as they would treat themselves and not to take advantage of him. Verse 34, the stranger, that is the non-Israelite who sojourns among you, shall be to you as the native among you. You shall love him as yourself. If he's an Arab, you love him as yourself. Remember that you were strangers in Egypt once and you didn't like it when people poked their noses up at you. So he says, make sure that you show kindness to these other people. One could go on. Verse 35, for example, justice in length, weight, or quantity, just measures, just balances, just weights, so that everything is honest and above board. So those are some of the social responsibilities. If we go back now, look at my second category, which I'd call superstitious practices. Verse 19, you shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind, you shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall there come upon you a garment of cloth made of two kinds of stuff. I believe that perhaps they apply to superstitious practices. Now, I'm not saying that's the only interpretation, but I'm just saying perhaps that's what he's talking about, because certainly we see that in the East, where people will have certain threads woven through their clothing to bring them good luck. The priest is blessed and they weave these things into their fabric. They will sow their fields with grain that a priest has blessed, mix it with the rest, and of course that's going to give you a good yield. It's a sort of super blessed fertilizer of some sort. So perhaps these are superstitious practices that he's referring to. Whether they are or not, I think that verse 26 certainly is a reference to superstitious practices. That is the latter part of the verse where it talks about not practicing augury or witchcraft. And verse 27, you shall not round off the hair on your temples or mar the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuttings in your flesh on account of the dead or tattoo any marks upon you. These again were superstitious practices. They cut the beard into certain shapes, they cut the hair into certain shapes, they cut themselves, they've got scars on them that mean things, they put tattoos over them. And again, you see this very rampant in the East where A chap will have a little area the size of a 1 cent piece on his head somewhere, and he never cuts that. It grows way down here, 18 inches long. The rest of his hair he cuts, but this little bit hangs down. Or a few hairs growing out of a mole on his face, and they get 9 or 10 inches long. They're supposed to bring good luck. Very superstitious and these sorts of things. We've got one of the Christians in our church. The whole of his back is just covered with tattoos. Not buxom girls and things like that, but sacred writings from the Bali and Sanskrit writings of Buddhism. We've got another fellow who's got marks, scars that have been put in his arm by priests, slashed in different configurations, which is there for keeps as some sort of protection from the gods. I'm sure that that's the type of thing they're talking about, because that's what they met in Canaan, and later on, in fact, you find it talked about in Canaan, the prophets of Baal slashing themselves with knives and various other marks that are referred to in the prophets, where people put these tattoos on themselves and so on. So there's some of the superstitious practices. Verse 31, again, superstitious practice has to do with mediums and wizards. That's my second category. The third category I would call simply helpful tips. Now, verse 19 again may be simply a helpful tip concerning cattle breeding. Don't let your cattle breed with a different kind. Don't sow your field with two kinds of seed. And don't let a garment made of two kinds of stuff come upon you. This may simply be a helpful tip so that in the interests of technical purism, they might get the best of things and not mix up their seeds in such a way that they're going to reduce the yield from their crops. So it could be some sort of tip like that. And likewise, verse 23. Remember that these people had never been farmers before. They'd been brickies labourers, that's what they'd been. They'd been road diggers and things like that. And for the first time, they're going to be farmers and orchardists. So verse 23 gives a few tips for the budding orchardists. When you come into the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you. It must not be eaten. In the fourth year, you take the fruit and you present it to the Lord in thanks to him. And then in the fifth year, verse 25, you can start to market the stuff. You can start to use the orchard to produce cash crops and sell your fruit for profit. And this again apparently was some sort of tip so that they wouldn't be too greedy and too anxious, but by a correct pruning of the trees and nurturing them, in the long run, they would get a better yield from their trees. Well, one could go on. Now, putting these three chapters together. All of us hold, I should hope, good Christian values of morality, and we would like to uphold those standards in a society that tramples on them. And we would go to these verses, such as the ones about sex and homosexuality and bestiality and all these other rather hideous things, and we would like to quote those verses, wouldn't we, and throw those at the other people and say, this is what the Bible says. But we're embarrassed a bit because sandwiched right between them in the very same Bible are all these things about not wearing a shirt made of two kinds of stuff. Terraline and cotton is out, and so there's a verse to say you can't do that. You can't have cabbages and beans growing in the same plot because the Bible says you can't. So that's a bit odd, you know. What's this Bible on about? And so we think to ourselves, what are we going to do? Chapter 19 is going to be pretty embarrassing for most of us if we try to put all those laws into practice exactly as they are. And yet chapter 18 and chapter 20, which talk about the sexual aberrations, we find those very supportive and we'd like to quote them. So this is the question that I'd like us to ask ourselves. How do we use the Bible? Are we entitled to use these verses about homosexuality and free sex and so on? Are we entitled to use these things to support our Christian stand? Well, if we are, then surely by the same token, if chapter 18 applies to us, well, chapter 19 has to apply too. I mean, we can't pick and choose the ones we like and throw the others out because we don't like them. So what are we to do? Well, my answer would be this, and this applies not only to Leviticus but to the whole of the Bible. It's basic to Bible interpretation, really. What we must always do is find out why the thing was written. Why was it said? Who said it? To whom? When? Why? For what reason? And when you look at that, you have the clue as to how we can use it. We ask ourselves, why was this put there? And on the basis of the answer, we can then decide whether it is something that applies to us or whether it was of limited application and applied only to Israel. Now take the cases that we gave, those four cases of the sexual matters. Did you notice the four words? In chapter 18, verse 22, concerning the homosexuality, they said it is an abomination. In verse 23, concerning the bestiality, they said it was a perversion. In chapter 20, verse 14, concerning the chap who had a girl and also the girl's mother at the same time, they said it is wickedness. And in chapter 20, verse 17, concerning the boy that was having sex with his sister, they said it is shameful. Now, the four words that are used there are abomination, perversion, wickedness, and shameful. Each of those is a moral word, and it has nothing to do with the ceremonies of Israel, nothing to do with the rituals. It is a moral judgment. They didn't say anything about the coat made of two kinds of stuff being wicked or an abomination or a perversion, because it wasn't a moral thing. When God is giving these instructions concerning the matters of sex, for example, the adjectives that are used there are adjectives of judgment in general. They have nothing to do with the ceremonies of Israel, nothing to do with the rituals. And because of that, we, I believe, are entitled to quote those, because they are reflecting the universal, eternal values which God desires for human society. And there's nothing in those verses to say this is concerned only with the rituals of Israel. So we have to ask ourselves these questions. Now, when we look at the rituals of Israel, we find that some of the things, some of the laws given here are simply for ceremonial purposes. Take, for example, the cleansing of the mother after childbirth. Now, there was nothing there to indicate that there was any moral problem anywhere, but it was a ceremonial thing. Take the cleansing of the leper. Again, there was nothing morally wrong, but the ritual that that man went through was part of his ceremonial cleansing and restoration to the religious life of the nation. When you look at these other things in chapter 19, you find that some of them are simply as helpful tips for junior farmers. Some of them are concerned with superstitious practices that they're going to meet. But then there are other things where the judgment, the word that is used, reflects a moral value, a moral standard that God requires. And so that's why he uses such words as wicked, shameful, abomination, and perversion. There's no simplistic way of going about the Bible. We have to apply ourselves to understand it and then to see why it was written and then apply it meaningfully. If we do that, we won't fall into the trap that sometimes people fall into of getting themselves all tied up in knots over these things, getting carried away on issues such as chapter 19 and trying to apply them willy-nilly, or the food laws of Israel and trying to impose them blanket upon everybody else. Because in those sections we find the reasons for which they are given. But in these other issues, the reason which is given is one which reflects a universal and abiding value. So much then for chapters 18, 19 and 20. In conclusion, chapters 21 and 22, I'm not going to go through these two chapters. They contain a number of rules for priests. Chapter 21 tells us that because the priests were the people's representatives, they had to have no uncleanness and no physical defects. That's a very obvious point, I suppose. The reason being that if the priest was to act as representative of a people, he should be as near perfect as possible, just as the animal which was offered as a sacrifice in substitute for the person had to be as near perfect as possible. So it goes on to say here that if a man was crippled or a hunchback or had a deformed foot or things like that, he couldn't offer the sacrifices on behalf of the people. He could still be a priest, but he wasn't able to do all the rituals, because the very act of the priest doing those rituals was to symbolize that he was the representative on behalf of the person. The priest that was disadvantaged in some way like this had the same rights as all the other priests to receive his income and to engage in the less public affairs, but he was not allowed to participate publicly in the altar ceremonies. That seems to be a fair sort of an arrangement. And chapter 22 tells us that the food that was eaten by the priests was not eaten by them alone, but it was shared also among their families. Now, you know that the priests had wife and children and grandchildren and other relatives who all lived in the house, and they too were fed out of the food which was taken by the priest. So that was part of the way the priests got their income, through the people's offerings, the offerings of the animals, and their daily food was provided very largely from the sacrifices which the people brought. But as I say, it was shared around among the extended family that lived in his household. That's chapter 22. All right, we'll leave it there for the time being. That's a quick run through chapter 16 to 22, a rather miscellaneous lot, but I hope that you find one or two points there that can be instructive to us, and as you think them through, you might be able to find out how we can apply those to our situations today.